we can't even find a support band in Liverpool. How are we gonna, where are we gonna get support bands from? And he said, well, we'll have to grow our own. I don't care who they are or what they're doing, but, you know, if they've got the brass neck to go out with a name, Sex Pistols, I think we should book them. Pete has to rent new premises, hire new staff, train them. They can't open the envelopes fast. They can't get them to the bank quick enough, you know. Roger Eagle and Pete Fulwell had implored me not to make anything of my connection with Queen because they were considered to be deeply unfashionable within our target audience.
Liverpool is a wondrous place.
From Maysebee to Brookside.
Eric's to the Everyman.
This podcast tells the city's stories.
Whether you're a proper scouser
or just a day tripper.
Listen in to learn something new about Liverpool.
Drawing on the past.
Present
and future.
The iconic.
And under the radar.
Looking at the people.
Places and moments that make Liverpool what it is.
This
is the National
Museum's Liverpool podcast.
On the 8th of October 1976, a queue of punks blazed down Matthew Street in what's now known as the City's Cavern Quarter, made famous by the Beatles. Making its way around the block, the line led unceremoniously to a propped open fire door with fans straining to hear the music inside. The band was the Runaways, and the venue? Eric's. Eric's had opened just 1 week earlier to a music scene that hadn't seen a great deal of action since the city soared in the 60s with Merseybeat. Eric's was more than happy to fill the gap and became a home of sorts for some of the most influential Liverpool bands and figures of the late 70s. Without Eric's, you may not have seen the rise of bands and figures like Echo and the Bunnymen, The Teardrop Explodes, Pete Burns, Pete Wiley, or Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. Eric's was a key point on the touring circuit and helped fuel the music subculture of the time. By the 80s, turn on the national radio and you'd hear many bands that had graced Eric's roster. The Police, The Clash, Blondie, Joy Division, Ramones, Sex Pistols, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Susie and the Banshees, and The Slits. Our guest on the episode, Ken Testey, was there for it all. Back in 1976, he started Eric's with his friend and business partner, Roger Eagle. He was a born promoter and band manager, starting as early as school, during which time he met Freddie Balsera in London, before he became Freddie Mercury. He went on to support Queen's early career, booking them gigs in Liverpool and generating interest for record labels in London. Ken has rubbed shoulders with more bands than you could imagine, but the one closest to his heart, which he still manages today, is Liverpool's hugely influential art rock new wave band, Deaf School. In many ways, Eric's began with Deaf School, not just because they played the opening night along with the Stranglers, but because they injected the Liverpool music scene with a new energy not seen since the Fab Four. This story is one nearly as chaotic and wild as the nights at Eric's. With so many tales spilling out of Ken, it's been a challenge knowing where to start. Here he is describing his early years at school and his first encounter with Deaf School.
I'm doing a few shows here and there. I managed to persuade the local vicar to give me the church hall and persuaded the head teacher to give me the school hall, booked the Queen's Hall in Widnes, and later some rooms above pubs. Just, you know, relatively small stuff, but I was moving bands around and eventually bringing bands up from London. And from school, I became the driver and fixer for the school band. And we were able to penetrate a few of the Liverpool clubs that were still running at the time. We did the Cavern in the 60s, the original Cavern. I started to learn bass guitar and formed a band with Mike Bursin, Lou Rosenthal, and Jeremy Lewis. Jeremy Lewis later set up Amazon Studios in Kirby, which had previously been known as Liverpool Sound. He later moved into the city centre and became Parr Street Studios. On our last night, which was at O'Connor's Tavern on Arden Street, a new band from the art college asked if they could support and would it be all right if they borrowed some of our equipment. And it was made known to me that there were rather a lot of them, possibly as many as 15. They kept moving around so you couldn't count them easily. So I went to one of their rehearsals to check out what they might need to see if I could pull it in if we didn't have it. And they were just brimming over with ideas. And when I saw them perform those ideas live at the show at O'Connor's, I was absolutely blown away. I've never seen such disregard for what had gone before. They were just breaking new ground at every step, and they still do it. And here I am 50 years on, still working for Deaf School. I think when the Beatles left town, 64, effectively turned the creative lights out. I mean, Merseybeat did continue for a few years after that, but the drive had gone, the creativity had gone, and it was just repetitive, same old, same old. Imagination really wasn't there. There was nothing new going on. There was nothing really creative at all. And it took an injection from the art college to deliver what was really needed at the time. And we went forward into the 70s with Deaf School wielding really a lot of influence. They influenced a lot of the acts that emerged thereafter.
Ken began managing Deaf School, and it was during this time that he met his co-conspirator, Roger Eagle.
I'd met Roger at the Twisted Wheel in Manchester doing a show with Ibex, the boys from Witness. And I then met him again when Queen performed at the stadium supporting Mott the Hoople, reintroduced myself. People think, generally, that Roger was the promoter at Liverpool Stadium. That was very, very rarely the case. He was more an agent for the stadium. So Roger didn't make tons of money out of the stadium. He had the ticket agency and an advertising budget and a few bits and bobs. So he looked for little promotions he could do outside of the stadium. It was probably through Jeff Davis at Probe Records that Roger found out about Deaf School. We started working for Roger at a venue called the Metro, which was a series of vaulted chambers, not unlike the Cavern in its arrangement of space. And we did a few shows there for Roger. They were very successful, and Deaf School were now moving towards their successful bid to win the Melody Maker competition. They signed the deal with Warner Brothers when they won and signed a management deal. And as soon as Roger had to deal with management, he was out.
Even if management wasn't his thing, it turned out Roger and Ken's roads were destined to merge. And once they did, things moved pretty quickly.
He had tended to work one venue, Liverpool Stadium, with many, many acts. And I was working with one act in many, many venues. It became apparent to me, early 76, that I clocked up enough penalty points on my licence, I wasn't going to be able to stay on the road for much longer. And I was asking Roger what he was going to do after the stadium, because we knew by that point the stadium was going to close down. So I knew that I was not going to be able to continue with Deaf School, and Roger knew that he wasn't going to be able to continue with the stadium. So what are you going to do, Roger? He said, I don't know, I thought I might start another club, you know. So I said, well, I'm going to be free. I wouldn't mind getting involved with that. And we started talking the thing up a bit. But one sort of had to realise that it wasn't just enough to take over one of the empty club spaces in town. If you looked at the music press of the day, which was Sounds, NME and Melody Maker, the back pages were full of ads for gigs, and the same gigs would come up week after week. And there were a handful of cardinal points on the touring circuit. And if you weren't one of those, you were virtually invisible. I mean, the Marquee was the one that led the pack. And it was necessary to get agents, bookers, all London-centric. You had to get their involvement, you had to get their confidence in what you were doing. we started to look for acts. We thought we'd look for somewhere that would be available from October. And I knew from work with Deskall that there were any number of clubs that were dying on their feet in Liverpool. They tried to drag the 60s into the 70s, and it hadn't really worked. Roy Adams, who had owned the Cavern, had tried to get Roger involved when he developed the new Cavern, which was a building in the Fruit Exchange opposite the original Cavern. Roy Adams thought that the new Cavern would be bait for a new generation of bands, but that was far too late for that. Roger wasn't interested at the time, but went back to Roy Adams with a view to taking some space from him, filling his club, which was empty. What he'd done, the new Cavern had failed, and he split it into two halves, and at ground floor level was Gatsby's. And in the basement section, he'd called it the Revolution Club, very Spartan. Down there. He spent all the money upstairs. So we got, first gig was upstairs. There was no stage downstairs. So the first gig we did, it was a support act for Deskall at the Roundhouse called the Stranglers. And I thought they had something. So we took it to Radio City, and the chap at Radio City said, look, I'm really keen to support you and Roger, and I'll do anything I can. He said, well, I can't play this, I'll get the sack. That was Phil Easton, bless him, the Great Eastern Express. They just couldn't grasp what it was we were trying to do.
Not dissuaded, Ken had plenty more ideas up his sleeve to get this venue going.
Over that summer, Roger and I, well, I particularly, had noticed a postcard-sized picture on the back page, I think, of NME, of a Californian band called The Runaways. I thought, I've got to try and book this. I found out who the booker was and the address in Wardle Street. So I went down for the day, and I got to this address, and there was a desk, two chairs, and a window overlooking Wardle Street. And he had an A3 pad on the desk, on his desk, and he was booking the Runaways tour. I put a date in, and when the tour was announced, against my expectations, we were on the tour sheet. We were in. The week before the Runaways show, the News of the World, which was a broadsheet at that time, had a double-page spread of the chaos outside the Glasgow Empire, the water cannon to disperse the crowd after the Runaways show. We didn't use the Gatsby's entrance because it was neon. We just opened a fire door on Matthew Street. A friend of mine, Kevin Ward, bless him, had painted an Eric sign, which I modified a bit, and we put that on a chair in Matthew Street. That was our entrance statement. And we had Doreen on the door. Doreen Allen was on the door for us. And I looked up the street. Our queue went down to the bottom of the street. I looked up, there was a queue at the top of the street. And I asked someone, what are they queuing for? I said, no, that's the end of this queue. And the queue had gone from Matthew Street, Temple Court, along Victoria Street, back into North John Street and back down into Matthew Street. And I don't think the Beatles managed that. We couldn't get the Runaways into the club because of the crowds. We had them driving around. We had no mobile phones, of course, in those days. But we got two-way radios, and as soon as we got the crowd in, we managed to get the band in. I stood at the stage right behind the PA, and I could see Roger's stage left. It was sardines in there. I think amongst the whole crowd, there were probably about three women, and one of those was Doreen. I'm 3 or 4 feet away from Joan Jett, a couple of feet further along is Cherry Curry, and they're delivering their California show, and it's going absolutely great. And I'm just thinking, doesn't get any better than this. The following week, because we'd been the only unknown venue on the biggest tour that was on the road at that time, every agent in London was calling us with their acts. And from that day forward, we'd never booked another show. they booked us. We had become a cardinal point on the touring circuit on week two.
The following weeks remained eventful, with a visit from the Sex Pistols, which saw them demoted to the basement, which, for a gig venue, isn't necessarily a bad thing.
So week three was the Sex Pistols. We knew nothing of the Pistols, because they hadn't worked outside of London. And I just said, well, I don't care who they are or what they're doing, but, you know, if they've got the brass neck to go out with the name Sex Pistols, I think we should book them, you know, just do it. Which we did, and that was the third show we did in Gatsby's. They broke so much glass in the dressing room, and they were just so horrible, and they didn't draw much of a crowd. Glenn Matlock was the only one you could speak to and get a reasonable response out of. Good chap. It was difficult, and it didn't need to be difficult. They just made it difficult, you know, which is what they did. So Roy Adams really didn't want us to do more, and he wanted to move us downstairs. So we went for another look downstairs at the Revolution Club, and I said, well, look, there's no stage, Roy, we can't work here. And he said, oh, no, I'll build a stage for you. You can, I'll do all that. Yeah, okay. He said, but you can't. And he said, I'm not having any more of that upstairs. He just put a new carpet in. it was never going to work. So we started working downstairs, and Roy wanted to sell the building. The whole new cavern thing hadn't worked. Revolution wasn't working. So we had to start thinking about not a 7-day-a-week operation, but it wasn't going to be sufficient to do one night a week and pay a mortgage. So we had to do more stuff. And I said to Roger, I said, well, we can't even find a support band in Liverpool. Where are we going to get support bands from? And he said, well, we'll have to grow our own, which was fine. I was fine with that because I'd worked with fledgling bands from school, and I'd worked with Queen extensively during their early recording period, and Deaf School as well. So I was right up for that. So we set about doing that too. Coincidentally, Deaf School went to America, and then went into an extended recording period for the second album. And they'd nowhere to store their PA system, so they brought that into Eric's. And because I toured with the rig extensively, I knew it very well. So I was able to operate that as a house PA. Now, you would expect most venues these days to have a house PA, but that wasn't the case at the time. So those fledgling bands that we were nurturing and bringing along, involving such luminaries as Holly Johnson, Pete Burns, Pete Wiley, Julian Cope, Echo and the Bunnymen, loads. What we were able to offer them, and we did this Saturday lunchtimes, what we were able to offer was the ability to hear themselves for the first time because there was a monitor system.
Eric's was becoming an epicentre for young new bands to benefit, not only from a proper setup, but a chance to meet like-minded people, where creative forces could collide and fuse. Big in Japan were the prime example. Often described as a reverse supergroup, band members later had links with The Lightning Seeds, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Susie and the Banshees, the KLF, and the Cream Nightclub. A key to its success was its membership scheme. Eric's was members only, entitling it to a special license which allowed it to stay open until 2 a.m. Meanwhile, matinee gigs allowed bands to play to fans under 18 and to fit in 2 gigs a day, enticing talent to the Northwest. The club was rolling by this point, but to move on to the next step, Ken and Roger needed a third string to their bow. Enter Pete Fulwell.
So Roger and I are getting offered the building and realised that we're going to have to up our game quite a lot, and we haven't got any money. So we started talking to Pete Fulwell. He was one of the main promoters through an outfit called Triad, who were regular promoters at the stadium. So that's how Roger got to know him. Pete also, he had a little design and promotion company. He had a designer working for him called Steve Hardstaff, who still works for Deaf School to this day, and was head of graphics at the Art College. Steve designed the Led Zeppelin poster for Wembley. Pete took the design to Led Zeppelin's manager, Peter Grant, who loved it. And Pete's deal with him was that he could sell the poster after the concert. On the week of the concert, Pete started advertising it in all the music papers. On the Monday after the concert, Postie turns up with a sack of postal orders and checks. On the Tuesday, there's a post office van that's full of bags with postal orders and checks. And on the Wednesday, it's a truck. Pete has to rent new premises, hire new staff, train them. They can't open the envelopes fast. They can't get them to the bank quick enough, you know. It's absolutely brilliant. And having made a killing, he sells the business and he wants to look for a tax-efficient way of using the proceeds. And he can get rollover relief if he puts it into Eric's. Brilliant. So there's three of us now. And it goes pretty well. And the Stranglers come back the second, third time. The Stranglers were sleeping on our floors. Two on my floor, two on Roger's. They came up in an ice cream van. Because Jeff Black, the drummer, had an ice cream business.
Against this haphazard backdrop, the trio bought out New Cavern Enterprises and the Revolution Bar, renamed it Eric's, and the club became a permanent venue. At its peak, the club had approximately 5,000 members, with about 100 hardcore regulars who showed up every week. Recognisable figures included Pete Burns and his amazing makeup, his wife Lynn with her kettle handbag, Jane Casey with a lampshade hat on her shaved head, Holly Johnson and Margie Clark. Amongst it all, I asked Ken, what were the most memorable gigs, and was it all punk and new wave?
The ones that most people remember, by definition, were the ones where most people were there. And also, by definition, there were very few people at the gigs that people don't remember. And there were quite a few of those. But we did a lot of jazz gigs. I think that was a Thursday night. Was it a Wednesday? Anyway, and Queen turned up to one of those. They were doing two nights at the Empire. So it was a quiet jazz night, and suddenly Matthew Street fills up with limos because they've all got their own driver. Which was terrific, you know. Roger really liked the jazz drummer, I remember. I was able to spend some time with Brian the following day. I mean, it was, really nice. No, I mean, nice of them to bother. Fortunately, there weren't many people in that night because Roger Eagle and Pete Falwell had implored me not to make anything of my connection with Queen because they were considered to be deeply unfashionable within our target audience at that time. They defined themselves, and none of them were going to see Queen at the Empire. You know. We shouldn't forget there was a really broad range. I mean, John Martin, for example. We did two or three shows with John Martin that absolutely rammed, but completely different audience from the guys that had come to see the Stranglers. And we were doing the Everyman Theatre had a touring company at the time, and they would do a pub tour each year. And they first couple of years that they started at Eric's because it was a sort of halfway house between a pub and a... It had some theatre elements in it, like a stage, you know. So, we did world premieres of dramatic work there, which was great. I mean, we were just an open platform. I mean, it was popular culture in its broadest sense. And we want, you know, I was up for anything at all. Pete Falwell described it as a Petri dish. We were breeding, you know, it was a growth medium. I mean, the very term cultural industries, creative industries, hadn't been coined before. And yet there we were, not only breeding musical talent, but we had a record label and we were doing some publishing and we were doing all sorts of creative things and inspiring others to get on and do the same. So you get Zoo Records spinning out of that as well. Great.
They also started a record company under the Eric's name, produced the Last Trumpet fanzine, and offered practical advice to musicians in their magazine, More or Less. With ideas spilling out of every corner, how can you sum up Eric's?
And I had this conversation with Will from Echo and the Bunnymen recently, because on a Saturday, I'd go and set the PA up and get the monitor system out. And so lunchtime, these guys would come in. And it was one after another, and Roger would be bullying them, famously telling Pete Burns that he was going to bar him if he didn't form a band, because he looked so Pete Burns. So he was just sort of feeding them in, and I'm going, yeah, right, what do you need? Yeah, have you got that? Right, OK, we'll just move that. And, you know, we put three or four acts through a week on a Saturday lunchtime, see what they'd learnt that week, see what they come back from the rehearsal room with. They could try it out. We provided a platform for popular culture, and we didn't much care which direction it came in from, what it's at. It was just a platform, because we were just confident that things would grow. That if you give them the space and you give them a bit of support and you give them a few ideas and you slap them around a bit, they'll be fine. Any direction would do, as long as they were going in some direction and being invigorated, chivvied along in some way. I think that they were just finding their feet, and having found their feet, well, because then record companies started coming up from London. It was a very creative time, and yeah, my word, there's a lot going on.
There really was a lot going on, and the live fast, die young ethos sadly played out for Eric's itself. Already under financial strain, their license came under threat as they allegedly turned a blind eye to non-members coming in. On the 13th of March 1980, the club announced its closure for the following week. But just 2 days later, Wear Heat were supporting the Psychedelic Furs when the final blow arrived. The late 70s had seen an increase in clubland violence in Liverpool, and although Eric's had managed to avoid involvement, it was raided that night. Amongst the chaos, Pete Wiley jumped on stage to belt out the recent Clash cover of I Fought the Law, and the law won. After some minor disturbances and a few arrests, the club was closed for the rest of the evening. The day after the raid, hundreds of fans marched through Liverpool city centre in a bid to save the club and protest its closure. But even hopes for a farewell gig with Susie and the Banshees never happened. The venue was closed for good. Both Ken and Pete have been quoted saying they didn't think the police intended to close them down. But after that night, their creditors came calling, and they were, as Pete put it, always in a precarious situation. Despite a run of under 4 years, Eric's has taken its place alongside the original Cavern as one of the most influential music venues in the UK. Music has always been and will always be core to Liverpool life. And Ken has an eye on Future Yard in Birkenhead as the next key venue for the region. Speaking to Ken, I was dropped into the frenetic, tense, but wholly alive world of Eric's. On the way out after the interview, I mentioned to him that Eric's appeared always on a knife edge, experiencing the highest highs and the lowest lows, to which he fixed my gaze and said, you know, it's the only way to live. I've been your host, Megan McGurk. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe to the National Museum's Liverpool podcast for more Liverpool stories, from the under the radar to the truly iconic.